Next is in the matter of Sal Greenman. May we please have appearances of counsel? And that's Mr. Greenman with you?
This is Mr. Greenman with me, Your Honor, yes.
This is a disbarment, potential disbarment case. Mr. Greenman, you'll have the opportunity, if you'd like, to address the court, and you're welcome to speak with your counsel when we reach that point in the proceedings.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McNamara.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Brabner, Justices of the Court. This case does not present a Wilson situation, and yet the Special Master, the Disciplinary Review Board, and the Office of Attorney Ethics are all recommending that respondent be disbarred. There were times during the OE's investigation, as well as even during the hearing, that it would have been hard not to feel sympathetic towards the respondent. He emphasized his age, health issues, difficulties he had going into law school and passing the bar. So how do we get to this point, and how do we recommend that respondent should be disbarred for his actions? Respondent was the subject of a 5-count complaint, which went to a hearing. The Disciplinary Review Board issued its decision on January 15, 2019, finding that respondent had violated multiple rules of professional conduct, gross neglect, lack of diligence, failure to communicate. All those were in two matters: practicing law while suspended, and committing a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. Again, in two different matters. The respondent was also found guilty of committing conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation in four matters. With regard to the Murray grievance, an attorney named Richard Murray reported that he represented an individual named Vadim Kaplan in a $250,000 claim against Israel and Lusik Ringwick. Murray sent the Ringworks a letter regarding the dispute with Kaplan. Soon thereafter, the respondent telephoned Mr. Murray asking for a meeting to discuss the case and potential settlement. Murray was willing to meet, but first he wanted a letter of representation from the respondent. Thereafter, Murray filed a complaint on behalf of his client, which was met once again with a telephone call from the respondent requesting a meeting. Murray again asked for a letter of representation. This time, Murray memorialized that conversation in a letter to the respondent. Murray later learned of respondent's suspension. According to Murray, all communication with the respondent occurred after respondent's February 20th, 2015 temporary suspension ordered by this court. During both conversations, respondent claimed to represent the Ringworks. Respondent did not dispute having contacted Mr. Murray on behalf of the Ringworks after he was temporarily suspended. He claimed he met with them while he was cleaning out his building after a flood. He indicated he was returning a partial file to the Ringworks based upon the flood damage that had happened to that file. Documents submitted by the respondent, however, established that the flood actually occurred a year after the Murray incident. Moreover, respondent denied having made more than one telephone call even after he was confronted with his written response to the grievance, in which he admitted making telephone calls. Respondent also testified that when he called Mr. Murray, the Ringworks were present to discuss legal fees they owed him for a prior case. Respondent contended that he was allowed to collect unpaid fees despite his suspension. With regard to the Oldfield grievance, an attorney named Richard Oldfield represented Allstate in a personal injury claim. Oldfield testified that because he had neither received a stipulation of dismissal or a release from the respondent's law firm to close the matter, that a settlement check was not sent. He testified he began receiving telephone calls about the money in early 2015 from both the respondent as well as his son, Jonathan Greenman. Mr. Oldfield testified that his communications with the respondent were in March 2015, after the date of respondent's suspension. Respondent never informed him that he was suspended and that the settlement papers that were being sent were sent from the law office of Sal Greenman. Respondent admitted that he called Mr. Oldfield from his office following the date of his suspension. When confronted with Rule 1:20-20B13, which places various qualifications on the allowance to collect fees already earned, respondent replied he was mistaken in his interpretation of the rule, but he steadfastly maintained that he was still allowed to collect that money, even though he was suspended. Because his argument was, I settled that case a year before the suspension. He further denied that clearing up files and any outstanding issues relating to that constitutes legal work. He also admitted that his law firm sign remained in place for more than a year after he was suspended. The check was made out to the respondent and his client. The respondent had no explanation as to how a check could be cashed if he was not allowed to maintain a trust account following his suspension. In the Fedotoff grievance, respondent undertook representation of Mr. Fedotoff in connection with Mr. Fedotoff's bankruptcy. Respondent accepted a fee from Mr. Fedotoff, and after 4 years, he had still not filed the petition. Respondent admitted that he never informed Mr. Fedotoff or Mr. Fedotoff's daughter, who was helping Mr. Fedotoff, assisting her dad with asking respondent for updates. Respondent never told either of them that he was temporarily suspended. He didn't perform any tangible work on Mr. Fedotoff's matter. Respondent did not return emails or phone calls and barely communicated with either Mr. Fedotoff or his daughter. And when he communicated with them, he provided false information to them. He lied to Mr. Fedotoff for years, assuring him that the petition had been filed and that the matter was progressing. Then he lied to Mr. Fedotoff's daughter, telling her on two dates that he would file the petition. In the Stabinski matter, respondent accepted money from Ms. Stabinski to assist her in a claim where she had to pay unpaid medical bills, and despite accepting that representation, respondent did nothing to further the matter. Eventually, a judgment for $11,708.03 was entered against her, and two of her bank accounts were levied upon, resulting in a double payment. Eventually, Ms. Stabinski herself contacted the court and learned that nothing had been received on her behalf regarding the levy from respondent's firm. Per her request, the court immediately lifted the duplicate levy from her bank account. Respondent attempted to blame his son, Jonathan Greenman, for the actions, but Ms. Stabinski had retained respondent. The check she wrote was issued to respondent, and he was the point of contact for Ms. Stabinski throughout most of the ordeal that she had in having respondent represent her. Ms. Stabinski made numerous attempts to communicate with respondent to no avail. Further, when she did communicate with the respondent, he lied to her, assuring her that the matter was progressing, that he was negotiating with the doctor's attorneys and the matter would eventually be resolved. Now, with regard to the disbarment recommendation, the Office of Attorney Ethics respectfully requests that the court take into account the following information. The board found no mitigating factors applied. In terms of aggravation, respondent was temporarily suspended on February 20th, 2015 by the court. On May 19th, 2016, respondent received a censure for failing to cooperate with disciplinary authorities. In addition, on May 30th, 2018, respondent received a 1-year suspension for committing gross neglect, lack of diligence, failure to communicate, and conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, and failing also to cooperate with disciplinary authorities. The 1-year suspension was given by the court on May 30th, 2018, and that was for a matter in which respondent was retained back on October 30th, 2008. The next aggravating factor is hostility to ethical standards. The special master found respondent to be an entirely untrustworthy and incredible witness. The board found that respondent displayed a willingness for deceit. Another aggravating factor is continuing course of dishonesty and misrepresentation. Respondent's conduct was not of an isolated incident, but his actions occurred over a period of years. His untruthfulness continued throughout the hearing. Respondent started representing Mr. Fedotoff in June 2011. He started representing Ms. Stabinski in November of 2013. Respondent's contacts with Mr. Murray and Mr. Oldfield, the two attorneys who filed the grievances, began in March 2015. Another aggravating factor is respondent's lack of candor with disciplinary authorities. Respondent's lack of candor occurred during the OAE's investigation and throughout the ethics hearing. Here are some examples from the special master. With regard to the Stabinski grievance, the special master found that respondent offered no believable or even coherent defenses to the allegations. The special master determined that respondent's testimony was evasive at best and intentionally untruthful at worst. The special master pointed out, respondent simply says whatever he believes will help him the most at that particular moment in time. Another aggravating factor is respondent's lack of remorse. In respondent's summation brief that he submitted to the special master, he argued he didn't commit any ethics violations. He also, in his summation brief, wrote that Mr. Murray, the lawyer who filed the grievance, he claimed that Mr. Murray's testimony was at best lies and at worst a fraud perpetrated upon the system. The special master found that the respondent's lack of comprehension or remorse for his conduct in this matter is remarkable. The special master also wrote, it is sad but profoundly significant that respondent continues to deny in his written summation to insist that he has done absolutely nothing wrong and that all the charges against him should be dismissed, especially given his repeated distortions of the facts of this case. Further, the special master indicated in his supplemental decision that not only did respondent fail to show remorse for his misconduct, he also engaged in personal attacks on his former clients, the attorneys to whom he had lied, and he had engaged in name-calling and totally unsubstantiated accusations against them. Respondent's argument in his post-hearing summation was that everyone else involved in the matter was at fault, not he, and all charges should be dismissed. As an example, he called one of his clients, Ms. Stabinski, for the fact that she would contest a medical bill and then make an allegation against him. His explanation of what she is, he said, she's a vulture. The special master added that respondent's actions were intentional, willful, criminal, and struck at the heart of the practice of law. Respondent's attempt to blame his son, his clients, and his reputed poor health lacked credence. By respondent's own evidence that was provided at the hearing, medical conditions which he suffered from over a decade ago had largely been controlled and mitigated. The special master also indicated that at the hearing, respondent demonstrated a shocking level of incompetence, evasiveness, denial, and self-contradiction amounting to lying under oath. And the special master gave examples about that as well. Respondent made an oral motion for which he acknowledged he had no legal or factual support. He falsely testified about the year that the flood damage occurred at his building. The special master pointed out that on virtually every page of respondent's own testimony, he denied facts, contradicted himself, and then responded fine when the truth was brought to his attention. Respondent testified he does not do legal research. He testified that if he practiced law again, he would do municipal court. He gave the impression at the hearing that if you do municipal court, you don't have to do research. When it was brought to his attention, well, you do have to do research in municipal court, and what would you do if a prosecutor filed a motion? Wouldn't you have to respond to that motion? His response was he would get someone to help him. When he was asked, how would he know if the person that's helping him is providing him with proper law? His response was, I don't know. The OAE concurs with the special master's statement in his hearing report that respondent's expressed desire to help the immigrant community of which he's a member by continuing to practice law ignores the fact that the members of that community, potentially all the more vulnerable due to their lack of awareness of our legal system, are precisely the ones injured by his actions in these cases. Respondent ignored this court's order when he practiced law even though he had been temporarily suspended. The Office of Attorney Ethics is concerned based upon respondent's own actions, based upon how he conducted himself during the hearing, what he was saying in terms of his defenses, that in the future, if he is suspended and not disbarred, he will be tempted again to practice law and then try to explain it off in terms of what he's doing. For those reasons, the Office of Attorney Ethics requests that you follow the Special Master's recommendation and the Disciplinary Review Board's recommendation, and that you disbar the respondent. Thank you.
Questions, anyone? Thank you. Mr. Confucio.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on Mr. Greenman's behalf. We would really rest on what we submitted in the papers, but the one thing that I would say is, in looking at it, my understanding is the court really is going to look at the punishment that's warranted for the case. I was not involved in the disciplinary proceedings below at all, and I'm really here just as an advocate for Mr. Greenman, because he knows I've made arguments before an appeal, and it's not really an appeal, but it's similar. But here's the bottom line. Looking at it from a disciplinary standpoint, the board itself on page 38 of its decision says, ordinarily, the conduct at issue, for which, by the way, we're not making an excuse of, I'm not here to contest any of the individual charges. I don't think that's before the court. But looking at it from a punishment standpoint, the board said the presumption is it falls below disbarment, this conduct. And as we pointed out in the papers, if you look at the individual infractions, there really were four that were substantiated. None of them individually, while I'm not certainly making light of them, they're all ethical violations and they're all important for us as attorneys, but none of them fall within the kind of typical category of an offense that might warrant disbarment, like a theft of funds or some kind of a heinous criminal act outside our profession. None of them are in that category. And for the case law that I cited in the brief, it talks about cases of that nature warrant generally something less than disbarment, and the exact punishment will be up to the court, but more like a suspension or in some cases even something less. Now, what does the board say that objectively justifies going from the presumptively less than disbarment to the disbarment? I don't think if you objectively look at the record of this case and try to apply the touchstone of the punishment, which it seems to me is not punishment. The court has said before that the touchstone is enough of a punishment to preserve the integrity and protect the public from these kinds of attorneys. That's basically it. That's the goal essentially of the ethics punishment. And in that context, if you look objectively at other cases that we've cited in the papers, this case, even in combination, does not rise to that level. It doesn't merit disbarment. And again, I don't want to get too far into the specifics of some of the cases we cited, but, again, it's not a theft of funds type of a case. Previous discipline, yeah, that's certainly a factor, and we're not going to say that it's not a factor. But I don't think that the previous discipline in this case, which is relatively, if you look at it from this standpoint, Mr. Greenman came to the law later in life. He was admitted, I believe, in 1993. And, we're not making excuses for the infractions he's had since 2015, but the fact is, for most of his career, at least, he did have an unblemished ethical record. I also think it's important that since this court looked at his matter about 8 months ago, or whatever my math is, but last summer, essentially, and it gave him a one-year suspension, The incidents that are at issue here, the four matters, those aren't things, in other words, that occurred after that. Two of them, in fact, if you look at the specifics of the matters, the two of them out of the four don't really involve clients. They're really complaints from other attorneys. Now, I'm not saying that, again, to minimize it, but in other words, the point is these are not practicing while suspended law in terms of I made a phone call for at least what two of his clients came in and testified on his behalf was, please make a phone call for me because we barely speak English. That was in the second matter, I believe, or the first matter, actually. That is not the kind of grievance standing alone that, for example, is I practiced while suspended and I went out and got 10 tort cases and I blew statute of limitations on three of them. So I'm not minimizing it from an ethics standpoint, but I am trying to point out that from a consequence standpoint, thankfully there really weren't any major consequences in the first two matters that we had discussed. Now, the second two matters with the two clients, again, we accept the findings of the special master, and there certainly should be punishment for them. But thankfully, in the second matter involving Ms. Stabinski, I think her name is, thankfully she was able to be made whole again. You know, now, again, I'm not saying that Mr. Greenman didn't do something wrong. He did, and we've had the ethical violations. But thankfully, this was, again, not a case of some kind of a dramatic consequence from an attorney's wrongdoing. You know, he didn't take anybody's funds. I heard Your Honor asking about in the other case if there was evidence of, oh, did the attorney use funds for himself? I mean, we just don't have those kinds of facts in this case. And if you look objectively at those cases, again, the cases we cited in the papers, all those cases that are similar to Mr. Greenman's, and some are even a little bit worse, fall short of the ultimate death penalty of disbarment. And that's really the main issue, you know, is that there's not really enough in this record objectively to say, well, if it's a presumptive less than disbarment, do we have enough here out of these four ethics violations to go from, you know, the suspension to the disbarment, a suspension of some length. I know the court is very familiar with the case from the filings in it, and otherwise we would rest on what we said in the papers, unless the court has questions.
So please address something that sure. I find troubling, mm-hmm. and it relates to the protection of the public and other clients.
Yeah.
Respondent has come forward and part of the defense has said, I can't do legal research, I can't use a computer, I can't send emails, I can't type. Do his clients know this? When he retains them? When they retain him?
I don't know, Your Honor, because, you know, I don't see anything in the record. I saw that part of it that he said, I don't know. And I think what it is that he's, I don't want to say old school, but he's pre-computer and probably cannot do those kinds of things. But, right. And you're going to have a chance, Mr. Greenman, to address the court as well, but... But I do think that that's certainly a skill that's necessary to be an attorney.
What skill?
You know, being able to obviously do legal research is a necessity.
Even in municipal court.
Even in municipal court, and any function as an attorney, it's clearly part and parcel of what it is to be an attorney. So, you know, again, I don't confront that head on. I agree with the board in that respect that is a factor. But again, I don't think that factor takes us from something less than disbarment to pushing it over the edge to disbarment. You know, most of what we're here for is really just on the punishment. You know, we understand that these ethical violations occur, and we don't make excuses for them. And I do think that was a lot of the presentation was that, and I wasn't involved below, but I can say here on behalf of Mr. Greenman, he's not making any excuses for it. He understands the court is going to essentially decide his fate, but he does ask that given the objective analysis of the other cases and the punishments that have been posed in other cases and just looking at his, that his warrants something less than disbarment. What it would be, that's up to the court, but something less than the ultimate penalty of disbarment, which would completely blemish and destroy the man's entire career.
Questions, anyone?
How many years has your client not been practicing at this point?
Essentially since the temporary suspension 2015, except, of course, for the couple of times. The two phone calls, I believe, in the Murray and the Oldfield matters, the first two matters where he's communicating with adversaries in prior cases, occurred kind of right around the time of suspension. They were after it, and I accept that. That's what the special master found, but... He really hasn't been practicing but for those incidents.
Has your client been employed in the last 4 years?
No, he is not. No, he's essentially retired, Your Honor. He has had health problems. I know that was somewhat of a discussion in the proceedings below, but he continues to, I guess, have some health problems, right, Mr. Greenman?
I do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for hearing me.
You'd like to speak privately, Mr. Greenman, or is he prepared to speak to us?
I think he would like to say.
I would.
Thank you, Robert.
Good afternoon, judges. As you know, my name is Sal Greenman, and I'm 72 years old at this time. Going back to doing the legal research, no, I do not use a computer. I do not type. Unfortunately, I missed that era. I was in business for myself for many years. I did not open a textbook in 20-some years. I went back to law school. I was 42, 43 years old. I missed it.
Are you saying you don't do legal research of any sort?
I do use the
books. Or otherwise?
I do use the books. And I do take technical courses, and I do have the pamphlet for the municipal court for, you know, real estate. I did a lot of real estate in some municipal court myself. My son did mainly everything else. I had many health issues starting back in 2007 and going all the way to the present, such as two herniations, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high diabetes, out of control diabetes. I passed out, I had a heart problem. I have pacemaker installed in me. I do not see out of my right eye. I do not drive at night. My wife drives me to places that I'm not familiar with. That's my health issues.
May I ask you a question? I just want to clarify this point about research. In the DRB's decision, it says that you admit you have never done research. Is that incorrect?
On the computer. That is true.
Only on the computer?
Only on the computer.
And in the Stubinsky matter, that too came up as a defense, that you did not know how to perform legal research.
Your Honor, I never handled the Stubinsky case. The only reason I saw Ms. Stubinsky's, I saw her two times. The first time is she came in, she called my office. As so happens, I speak Polish. But Ms. Stubinsky saw my ad in a Polish paper. She called me for an appointment. I came in to see her early in the morning, and she gave me a check for a certain amount, and she said she'd come back. I gave the case to my son, and he handled it. Ms. Stubinsky speaks English very well, but the original meeting was because I thought she could not speak English. As a matter of fact, Your Honors, if you look back at all four of these clients, everyone is an immigrant, and every one of them, I speak their language, starting with Polish, going to Ukrainian, going to Russian, and going to Hebrew. I speak all these languages. That's why I got involved with these clients. As soon as I got involved with them, I gave most of them to my son to handle. He handled these clients. Now, going back to what Mr. McNamara said, that I did not show any remorse, that is not true. I showed remorse immediately. I apologized to Mrs. Stubinsky for calling her a vulture, and I'm still sorry that I ever said such a thing. As a matter of fact, when my psychiatrist testified at the hearing, one of the questions was, did Mr. Greenman show any remorse? And his response was, oh boy, he showed a lot of remorse. And I do, and I did. Your Honors, I made mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes, and I apologize for them. But at this point, I would like this court to give me another chance, and I put my life in the mercy of the courts, and hopefully I can have some favorable results. One more thing, Your Honor.
May I ask you a question, sir? Sure. In your written submission, you talk about your desire not to, you know, your reputation is involved in not having a disbarment on your record. Is it your hope and wish and intention that if we were to grant relief along such lines that you would return to the practice of law?
Your Honor, let me just briefly speak about that. Currently, my wife and I have four grandchildren. As so happens, the other grandfather is also an attorney. I don't want one day for my grandchildren to distinguish me and the other grandfather by saying, this is the grandfather that got disbarred. As I said, I'm 72 years old. You know, any long period of suspension would probably be the end of me. I don't know how much I have, none of us do, but I certainly have not, I do not have good health at this point. I have not had good health since 2007. In 2007, I passed out, and I was rushed to Englewood Hospital with heart problems. Since then, I've been suffering every day.
Sir, if you were given a suspension, Is it your intention at the end of the suspension period to practice law again, or you just wouldn't practice anymore?
Your Honor, I don't know how my health is going to be. At this point, I cannot drive. My wife brought me here. I cannot drive.
Can I infer from that answer that if your health is fine, you intend to practice law at the period of suspension?
Maybe part-time. Okay. Certainly not open my own office. Those days are over with. Perhaps part-time just to keep busy. Because somebody asked, what did I do for the last 4 years? I can give you my schedule. I was watching People's Court and Bonanza and Gunsmoke. That's what I've been doing. My wife is my sole supporter. She works very hard, and she supports the household at this point. And again, if I had to do it all over again, I would do it differently. I'm sorry about that. I certainly did not mean to insult anyone. Your Honors, my reputation is very, very important to me. I've been in many businesses. I've been in real estate. I was a stockbroker. I had my own business. And no one ever said anything derogatory about me. When I heard Mr. McNamara before, and I heard him before say the same kind of thing, I didn't know what he was talking about. It wasn't me. It just, things happened. And I'm sorry about that. I really, truly am sorry about that.
Thank you. Court's in recess for the day. We'll take the matter under advisement.